tent several months before, and poor Damash had led an expedition to recover it and been cut up by the Gallas. From that he passed on to the Crimea and the American War, and I noticed that Cameron, Blanc and Prideaux had nothing to say. But Rassam was in like quicksilver, always echoing Theodore, and evidently afraid that I'd put him in the shade, having been in both campaigns. I took no part until Theodore summoned his little son, Alameo, a bright nipper of six, and I chafed him about going to rugby, while Rassam listened with a stuffed smile. But not a word was said about Napier or Theodore's intentions, and I could feel Prideaux fairly bursting with impatience beside me. At last Theodore said we might retire to rest in a tent that had been set aside for us, and we withdrew, except for Rassam, who stayed, hinting that he'd be glad of a private word in the king's ear. "No doubt to pay him a few well-chosen compliments," says Prideaux. "Would you believe he wrote Theodore a letter congratulating him on getting all his artillery to Magdala? He'll be offering to taste his food next." "Policy," says Blanc, shrugging. "Theodore likes him, and if he takes advantage of it, do we not all benefit?"
"I just wish he didn't seem to like Theodore quite so much," says Prideaux. "I like to be sure our spokesman is on our side.
But that's no matter," he added, turning eagerly on me.
"However did they come to take you, sir? And what can you tell us? Is Napier about to attack?"
I had made up my mind to tell them nothing of my mission to Mastiat, on the principle of least said, soonest mended, and also I was leery of Rassam. So I said I'd been on a long scout and run into an ambush. Napier I believed to be no more than a day's march away. But did Theodore mean to fight him? That was the point. I asked if they had any notion.
"All we know is that he is insane," says Blanc, "and altogether unpredictable. He has received a letter of ultimatum from Sir Robert Napier, and Rassam urges him to write in reply, but it is dangerous even to hint that he would be well advised to sue for peace."
"Theodore will fight," says Cameron, sounding dog-tired. "He cannot back down now."
"Then God help us all," says Blanc. "But I believe you are right, Consul. Even if he faces certain defeat, he will give battle out of pride and superstition. Oh, he is ruled by his astrologers and his lunatic fatalism. You heard him just now lamenting his lost rifle. He regarded it as a talisman, and is sure that catastrophe will follow if it is not recovered. That is why he is here at Magdala, nothing but superstition."
Seeing my expression, he laughed and explained,
"Magdala is another talisman. He believes that while he holds it, he cannot fail. Only last week he cried aloud that while he had lost all Abyssinia, Magdala remained, and he would hold it and emerge as a conqueror. He truly believes so."
"He can't believe it,"
automatically I added.
"He must be
mad," said Prideaux.
"You've noticed, sir. Yes, His Majesty is a trifle erratic."
"We can thank God for it," says Cameron. "If he didn't think of that rock as a symbol of victory, he would not have determined to hold it, and God knows where we would have been taken to by now. At least we're here, where Napier can find us."
They were silent, and I knew they were thinking, "If we survive." At least they were sane enough to do nothing but wait. No wild talk of trying to break out or blow up the powder magazine, which was only a few yards from our tent by the artillery park. Captivity had taught them patience. That was evident from what they told me of schemes for escape that had been considered and rejected, of plots with the rebels to storm the Amber in Theodore's absence, and of the hideous consequences of conspiracies gone amiss, with the guilty being mutilated and flung over cliffs, and one girl of 16 being flogged to death with giraffes. Small wonder that attempts to suborn their jailers hadn't got far, although in some respects, even leading men on the Amber had been helpful and friendly, despite the risk of arousing Theodore's displeasure. Thus, there had been a continuous correspondence carried on with our politicals in Egypt and Aden, with letters sewn into the clothes of Ab couriers and supplies of money and comforts coming in for the prisoners. You may read about it at length in the memoirs of Blanc and Rassam, if you've a mind to, and it's the strangest tale. In a way, my own experience of Theodore mirrors it in miniature. For sometimes they've been treated as honoured guests, sometimes beaten and tortured, splendidly fed with luxurious dinners of seven courses and loaded with chains, well housed and allowed the freedom to wander, tend their gardens and promised early release, then dragged away from one prison to another. There had simply been no pattern to their strange existence. No wonder, when Samuel the Ferret came to summon us back to the royal presence, my companions exchanged anxious looks. Now what? Wonders